Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that showcases today's innovators who are making the future happen. And making the future happen with me this week is space architect, technologist, and self-proclaimed, I better get this word right, Marsophile, Melody Yasher. Melody, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
It's a pleasure. And I'm not sure that Marsophile is the right word, but it sort of sums up what you do. I mean, more prosaically, you and your startup team at Icon focus on, I'm going to give you a quote here, okay? It's the intersection of space exploration, human-machine collaboration, and architecture that centers around well-being on Earth and other planets. So it sounds to me like you're talking about 3D printing on Mars and 3D printing of Mars habitats. Okay, I'm intrigued.
Yes, that's right. So I'm one of the few who can call myself a space architect as well as a terrestrial architect. And the focus of my work in the last 10 years has been on additive manufacturing, and in particular, thinking about how 3D printing can enable new ways of building terrestrially to really crack a dent in what traditional means and methods of construction have meant for housing on Earth, and then thinking ahead to what that's going to mean for designing for a permanent human presence in space in the short term on the moon and in the long term on the surface of Mars. And 3D printing is one of the few disruptive and enabling technologies that will actually help us build faster, more efficiently, more sustainably, and introduce a solution for how we can actually see future generations proliferate on the red planet.
Wow. So far from being, you know, some abstract, never to be executed Martian fantasy, a bit like, I guess, Donald Trump's hair, you're already printing or have printed a full-size prototype at the Johnson Space Center. So can you just tell me a little bit about how it looks and what were some of the issues and challenges you faced while doing it?
Yes, absolutely. So NASA awarded us a contract to demonstrate that we could 3D print a Mars analog, which is essentially a research environment intended to simulate a one-year-long Mars mission. So what we did is we collaborated with the NASA teams, human habitation teams, to design a 1,700 square foot structure that will house four people, four volunteer crew members, they're not actually astronauts, who will live there and actually perform and execute a Mars mission for an entire year. They'll be doing various kinds of activities having to do with robotic simulation, growing crops using aeroponics, and of course, we'll be using the opportunity to determine future standards for long-duration missions to Mars. This is truly a simulation in every sense.
So they can't nip out for a cigarette, for example, or if they want to go over and get a burger, they can't go out and pop back into an airlock and pretend they've been in there all the time.
Unfortunately not. They're basically stuck in this analog. We actually, NASA also fabricated a large sandbox to simulate what it would be like to walk on soil conditions on Mars. So they're pretty stuck between staying inside the analog and then going outside into this sandbox where they would actually be wearing VR glasses to approximate the landscape of Mars. So between those two places, they won't be able to do much more.
Your listeners to the podcast will be able to see what I'm going to call the rapid toothpaste squeeze construction of the habitat being made before their eyes. So I guess you use kind of time-lapse photography to show this happening. One of the questions that occurred to me when I was watching it is, where is the material to make this habitat coming from?
So our terrestrial applications, we use a mortar-based concrete material. In the case of the Mars Analog Project, we ended up dyeing this a sienna red just superficially, really, to make it look more Mars-like. So we do have that capability for all of our residential construction to dye our materials. But in an in-space context, What we really want to do is use the local and indigenous materials that are on the surface of the planet rather than bringing them with us from Earth. And that will really enable us to maximize our payload capacities for the things that are most critical for the mission. And then by using the materials on the land, living off of the land and constructing using in situ resources, we're going to be able to create a wide variety of structures that we would have never otherwise been able to accomplish.
Wow. So let me get this right. I guess it's a bit like frontiers people arriving in a new territory, a new country, and then using existing materials. But how is it being built? Because I guess the people are not there yet. Is it other robots, other extraction systems? How does it work when the first ships touch down on Mars? And then just talk us out to when the first people arrive to live in the habitat.
Yes. So this entire process of construction is theorized to happen even before a crew arrives. So the idea would be that we would have autonomous robotic systems that would go and survey Mars, define an appropriate site for a habitat or for infrastructure to be built. And then we would start to actually collect materials, collect the raw regolith, which is soil on Mars, process it if we need to, depending on the deposition or construction technology, collect those materials, and then basically additively manufacture the various types of structures that we would like to create. We'll start first by doing horizontal construction, which in the industry is basically anything that's flat in nature, so a road, a landing pad, or anything that doesn't require vertical deposition. And then eventually, once we go vertical, we want to be thinking about unpressurized garages, berms, and then eventually human habitats that are pressurized and certified for occupancy.
Wow. I mean, as a child, I guess, of the 60s and those early missions to the moon, and in fact, now even when I look at the International Space Station, I'm kind of aware that it looks a bit like, you know, Wally-E has sicked up, you know, his interior. You've got all these valves and wires and kind of ducts and that. And yet when I looked at the simulations and replica of the work that you were doing, I was going, wow, it's full of light, you know, tranquility, greenery, beautiful, harmonious order was probably the term that came to my mind, which really sends out messages about calm and well-being. Was that deliberate when you were thinking about the construction? Why not go the route of the ducts and the wires and the kind of whiz-bang computers?
Absolutely. I would say that the ISS functions and visually is very much a machine. And I mean, it needs to work that way. Mechanically, you need environmental control systems to actually keep people alive, maintain pressure and maintain breathable air and provide water and all of these other functions. But the truth is that for people to live for long durations in space and to actually have a sustained human presence in space, we want those environments to be as Earth-like and as familiar and comfortable as they can be. So this idea of introducing space architecture that just looks exactly like the space environments that are familiar to us doesn't really satisfy my desire to think more aspirationally for what it's going to mean to provide new experiences, new environments, and new types of structures and shelters for people in space.
I think it was, you know, fascinating because as well as the sense of creating a new aesthetic, it also, I think probably intentionally, gave me a sense of grounding of how it would cocoon me and protect me and make me feel in some ways more connected to a home I was familiar with. So it had an anchoring point to it. But then around it, it also reminded me of, I guess, the fantasy we have of space, about the slick lines, about curves, about plants in hydroponic systems, about couches we probably remember from Space 1999 or, you know, from, I think it was Moonbase Alpha. They had those great orange tartrazine couches made from kind of low-lying plastic. So I think it almost fulfilled a number of fantasies as well as the reality of what we're going to face when we get into these really inhospitable climates.
Yeah, I think that to a certain degree, science fiction and these techno-futuristic concepts of what it means to actually live in a highly technological society have impacted not only the way that we think about modernism on Earth, but also the way that we're going to imagine ourselves living in space. They both impact one another. So it's not surprising to me that a lot of the aesthetic tendencies that really appeal to us are those that are based in science fiction to a certain degree, and also based in how we imagine space.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's you know, science fiction iterates and then we build according to that ground plan. I mean, that's how I always see my job as a forecaster, is the future hasn't happened. So you're trying to give people the optimized or optimization of the opportunity. So they go, wow, that's what it could look like. And then here we go, we build it. Because I think we're not just talking Mars. You've also designed landing pads for the moon. So I guess that's going to be the stepping stone to our stepping off point to actually get to Mars.
Yes, that's right. We're going to need various kinds of infrastructure. Landing pads are going to be absolutely critical for any kind of resupply that will be required for a permanent moon base, which is what we're after. And then beyond that, once we have our transportation needs defined and we have a reliable way to get to and from the moon, we'll start to think about the other kinds of needs that we have in regards to building out a moon base that can satisfy both science and research interests, but also the interests of industry and those on the commercial side.
Well, if you think about, you know, the space program in the 60s and 70s, we weren't really thinking about commercial or corporate. Now, probably that would be our first consideration. You know, not, I guess the scientific is almost implicit, but we're really going to have to work out to finance these things, potentially, how corporations, how the kind of billionaires or hopefully the more enlightened members of our planet will cohabitate with the scientist and, I think, with the dreamer, because we also want to put dreamers out into space. I mean, this is why I found it fascinating that when I looked at the work you were doing, I was going, wow, you're not just applying a metric of science, of technology, of corporatism. You're also applying the metric of imagination and, I think, fantasy, because some of the landing pads I looked at, I was going, wow, they're almost out of Gerry Anderson via Arthur C. Clarke, via, you know, some of the creations from Spielberg. So when you're putting it together, how much are you really thinking about, you know, simulations, is science and CAD based and 3D rendering versus Melody taking what your fantasy and what your potential view of space should be and saying, wow, this is what it could be, and I would like other people to fall into my way of thinking?
I am a designer who employs an evidence-based process. So it's really data and science that drives initial design explorations. But I also believe that there is so much potential to explore formal ideas, aesthetic ideas, but most importantly, human-centric ideas that are mediated by, and let's say, regulated really by what the science and the evidence is supposed to show us. So, of course, all of these structures need to perform to a certain performance criteria. But beyond that, I think it's important to really dream and imagine what could be possible in the future and push the possibilities of technology development so that we can achieve structures that we've never built before.
Yeah, and I also think it unlocks, dare I say, pockets, because when people see something and they fall in love with it, they think, I really want to be part of that journey. Mm. So that, you know, the people who have the money will feel the same way. I think the scientists who really, you know, want new places and pathways to explore will fall in love with it as well. And I think I fell in love with it. The reason I think I did is because, you know, I saw these great habitats you'd built on Mars. You had what I call lunar landing plates, so these pads. I had an imaginary flash of astronauts tentatively moving across the Sea of Tranquility, you know, the Earth rising above them. So it's Earth rise rather than moon rise, what we would see on Earth. And it was kind of every girl and every boy's fantasy about what the future could look like. And I really wanted to kind of just take you back down to Earth a little bit and ask you, where did your kind of fantasy and obsession with this journey begin?
To me, space represents the pinnacle of scientific and technological achievement. And I find it both daunting and inspiring for those reasons. I was at a critical juncture in my career in architecture where I was basically doing mostly commercial and hospitality-driven work. And I realized I wanted to devote myself to creating spaces that were technologically driven and informed by technology first and foremost. So that was a critical juncture for me. And basically, I decided I wanted to devote myself to space research. And then through various series of events, the 3D printed habitat competition in particular, the idea of additively manufacturing structures brought me back to architectural design. So this confluence of architecture design and technology development for robotics and autonomy became this wonderful like melange of topics and ideas that I feel really passionately about.
Well, I mean, was there one image? Because for me, for example, it was that image, and I think it appeared on the Whole Earth catalogue. It was like the blue marble, the image of the moon, or rather the image of the Earth, sorry, because of course it was taken from outer space, not the moon, but the Earth, which made it look so vulnerable and at the same time so, you know, enticing and magical and in some ways alone out there in space. And I was thinking, oh my God, I want to be part of that moment. Was there an image or a thing that you would say that was my lodestone and that became the thing that opened and unlocked the door to me moving forward?
You know, every time I hear astronauts talk about the overview effect and seeing the Earth from the ISS as this blue marble in space, that has always really struck me as an experience that very few will have, and yet that is so critical to understanding our place within the solar system and our and the vulnerability, really, of our species on our planet. I'm not somebody who believes that we need to explore space or become interplanetary as a means of backing up humanity or like going elsewhere and colonizing elsewhere to escape an inevitable sort of situation on Earth. But at the same time, I think that so much of the work that we do for space brings back value to Earth itself and changes the way that we should envision and design and provide solutions for our Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sure it was Buckminster Fuller who described it as spaceship Earth. You know, when you saw that great image, it wasn't about desertion and it wasn't about jumping off into the great expanse. It reminded us of why fragility needs to be protected and, I guess, built on. And really, that was, you know, my moment of discovery. And what I kind of also felt when I was reading about your work and listening to the TED talk you did was how assured you were about the components of tomorrow and the way we would build tomorrow and what were the challenges you faced. So how did you construct all of that sort of, I guess, those fragments and pull them together in such a clear, coherent? And for me, it was like a blueprint of, if Melanie was kidnapped by aliens tomorrow, her blueprint is still here for us to go ahead and build this place. You'd come back in 500 years' time, you go, wow, hang on, what have they done? They've built my Mars station. How did you go about doing that?
It starts with thinking about infrastructure very holistically. I'm not somebody who is motivated by like designing the grand, like mega structures or structures at a large scale. But to me, thinking about infrastructure in terms of its constituent elements and the requirements of each of those structures individually has led to bigger picture ideas for what master planning is going to be like and what designing for resiliency is going to be like on the surface of the moon and eventually Mars.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to do the same thing again I did a few minutes ago. I'm going to take you back down to Earth. And I'm guessing that a lot of what you have learned by studying outer space and looking at the moon and looking at Mars is hugely beneficial to how potentially we could build on Earth. And when I was thinking this, I go, hang on a minute. I found this link to show that you had actually built 3D housing. And I want you just to talk me through that process. And again, some of the challenges and perhaps even expectations of the end buyer when they were seeing these things, which were not constructed using traditional means at all?
Yes, absolutely. So the houses that we 3D print at ICON are essentially concrete houses, and they look and they feel almost otherworldly in terms of their like surface texture and the quality of the interiors. Concrete to me is a brutal material. There's brutalist connotations to it, but at the same time, the houses are finished traditionally. So we use traditional materials for flooring and roofing. And there's a really wonderful aesthetic that we're able to create by mixing those materials and introducing new types and forms of architecture that have never been done before. That's really one of the key advantages of 3D printing. We're able to create organic shapes, three-dimensional forms, double curved surfaces, which using traditional means of construction, sticks and bricks, just aren't possible. They're prohibitively expensive. They take a very long time to do. So we're leaning into the potential of this technology to create new architectural experiences, geometric forms, and radically change the way that normal residential sector has designed housing for years and years.
Wow. I mean, I guess one of the issues, as I'm listening to you and thinking about traditional buildings, I know a bit about it from kind of previous projects I've worked on, is the rapacious nature of traditional construction and the damage it does in terms of CO2 outputs, also the kind of timber being used, slate, disposable frameworks that are used on the outside, the scaffolding, et cetera, et cetera. How did you avoid that route when you were having to create something that is it equally damaging in a different way? Does it not have the same environmental impact?
Yeah, the truth is that construction is one of the greatest contributors to carbon emissions worldwide. In our construction process, however, even though we're using concrete, we have the ability to only use as much material as is required to construct a house. So we're only squeezing as much material from that toothpaste bottle as is needed to print the structure. I came across a metric recently that said that traditional waste using stick frame construction can be on the order of like 4 tons for a single home, for a 2,000 square foot home.
Wow.
So it's the material efficiency and the fact that we also, using our material and our construction technology, we create a wall assembly for these houses that we're building at ICON that has significant thermal mass. And what that means is that we're able to retain heat much more easily than other building methods. And because of that, energy efficiency of the homes is much higher. And as a result, costs for the homeowner are also going to be much lower. So there's lots of efficiencies we're able to introduce.
One of the things, as you mentioned home over there, and I'm kind of thinking, what is the kind of demographic of the person that would buy one of your houses? Because when I had started explaining it to somebody, they would go, oh, so what? If I hang a picture, it's going to puncture the wall and the air is going to drain out. So they thought, 3D, and somehow you're inflating the house and then sealing it up on the outside. Or they said, oh my gosh, would I feel uncomfortable in this house that would be so unfamiliar? Or somebody said, whoa, whoa, wow, I'm not sure the conservative in me, this is the phrase they use, the conservative in me could live in such a place. I mean, what sort of people do you get coming, knocking and testing the walls? Who are they?
Functionally speaking, I think the reception of our construction technology, particularly the experience of the interior, has been overwhelmingly positive. People see the walls and it looks like a custom element. It looks like something really that like has this machine aesthetic, but at the same time is introducing so much texture and so much uniqueness to what would otherwise be a bland interior. Functionally speaking, it's just like a concrete wall. Really, you can hang pictures in the 3D printed wall. You can patch up those holes just as you would a concrete wall using some traditional grout. And it functions much in the same way.
I'm slightly disappointed now, I have to say, because I remember chatting to Zaha Hadid about one of her galleries. And, you know, the myth had been that it was great, but you couldn't actually hang a picture because the wall was curved and there were no curved pictures. And of course, when you went, it was all nonsense. So it was a kind of the myth. But I really wanted to believe the myth in the way that I had this imagination of somebody tentatively approaching one of your walls with a little nail and a hammer and being really cautious in case something spilled out. I mean, one of the things, when I was looking at both your housing work and looking at your work for Mars, I thought, gosh, if you scale this up and applied it to cities of the future, what are some of the things that you have learned that would really help us crack and solve the challenges that we're facing in cities in terms of, you know, population, in terms of density, pollution, making them friendlier for people? So what were some of the learnings that you've kind of gathered on the way that you're going to apply to that big project when you get asked to do it?
One of the enabling things about thinking about 3D printed construction at scale is that we're able to imagine construction happening much faster and much more efficiently than ever before. And because we have that opportunity, and because we're being asked to consider how to build entire neighborhoods of 100, 200 homes.
So it's happening already. Yeah.
It's happening already. Wow. Yes. We're actually in Georgetown right now. We're printing a 100-home community with the home builder Lennar. That's in progress as we speak. We have 6 printers deployed that are printing at the same time on site. So it's
excited. I actually am excited.
It's like something from the future, but the future is here, right? And so because we have this opportunity to think about building at scale in a way that has never been done before, I personally think we have an obligation to consider what that means in terms of the communities, neighborhoods, and also the effect that we have at scale when we're changing the fabric of a city or a neighborhood and community. And that, to me, is implicit in the design process. We have to be thinking about the impact that we're making to people who are living in these areas, and also the impact that's being made to the city itself.
Do you think about, because you're describing in some ways to apply technical term, the hardware of the city or the neighborhood, do you think about the software? So as well as the support systems that sit inside and the potential for, you know, aircon, filtering, heat, light, color, but also the, as technology improves, that we can upgrade these things. So do you build a sort of a subtle AI brain into the house or the street so that you can upgrade it when new things happen, or you just want to kind of get people further into the 21st century?
I really believe that smart homes of the future will be networked and will provide data to us about how we live and how we operate within our buildings and our homes. And that is going to enable us to be smarter about the resources that we use, the energy that we use, and also how we can think more holistically about the types of environments and communities that we are living within. So yes, absolutely. It's not something that's happening with the current projects that we have, but it's something that I look forward to very much.
I mean, this is the point, I guess, we're just nearing the end of our time together. And I really wanted to get you to dust down your warp drive. Okay, I'm going to get you to brush up on your Einstein. You're jetting off into tomorrow. And I want you to just tell me what the future looks like, according to Melody. What really would you like to see that then when you come back, you've got this fantastic story to tell me?
In the future, we will be able to describe the homes and communities, types of buildings that we would like to live in, and they will be autonomously and robotically constructed within neighborhoods that are inclusive, that are diverse, and that are democratically designed and appointed. I really believe that's something that we can work towards, and we already are.
Well, I'm slightly worried. I'm going to get a house that looks like Donald Trump, a ginger house or an orange house. So maybe we'll have to put certain constraints on that. But really, thank you again for speaking to me. Listeners can find out more at www.melodyyashar.com. And until next time, this is Martin Raymond urging you to keep looking, keep listening. I'm going to say in this case, keep printing and learning, and keep asking what's new and what's next.